From WJF Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Laura Flanders. She's the host and executive producer of The Laura Flanders Show, which airs on PBS stations nationwide, and her show is recorded right here in the Catskills, in a cabin. Laura Flanders joins us live this morning. The Center for Discovery, it's long been a leader in developing new models of care for individuals with complex conditions, and now a new report shows the Center for Discovery's model could hold the key to healthy aging. We speak to the center's president, Dr. Terry Hamlin. And To the Mountains by Rail, the landmark book that tells the story of the railroads that served the Catskills region and the resort industry that those railroads spawned. We talked to local historian about the book, local historian Myron Gattell about the book. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. Ukraine has not directly claimed responsibility for today's explosion on the only bridge linking the occupied Crimean Peninsula to Russia, but Ukrainian officials are posting celebratory messages on social media. Russian officials say the fire that erupted on the bridge was caused by an exploding truck. Three people are reported dead. And NPR's Kat Lonsdorf says at least part of the crossing has collapsed.
The 12-mile-long bridge is the primary supply route for Russian troops fighting in southern Ukraine. Videos posted online show huge flames and smoke pouring from a portion of the bridge, while another seems to have sunk into the sea. Russian state media reported that a fuel tank had caught fire and generally downplayed the situation. But pro-Ukrainian channels said it was an explosion and showed several sections in flames, suggesting a potential strike. Russian President Vladimir Putin personally unveiled the bridge in 2018 after illegally annexing the peninsula in 2014, using a sham referendum similar to those held recently in four other regions of Ukraine. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Dnipro, Ukraine.
Again, Ukrainian officials celebrating the explosion on Twitter. A presidential advisor calls the damage the beginning, and an official Ukrainian government Twitter account declared the blast a sick burn. Ukraine has previously said the bridge is a legitimate military target, but again has stopped short of claiming responsibility for the damage. North Korea says its recent missile tests are justified, and the North is slamming U.S. and South Korean military drills. The North has staged six missile launches in the past 12 days, including one missile that flew over Japan. As NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports.
State media said that North Korea's missile tests were normal acts of self-defense against U.S. military threats. It called exercises Friday and Saturday by the USS Ronald Reagan Aircraft Carrier Strike Group a bluff, but said the drills were worrisome and that Pyongyang is monitoring them closely.
Stocks fell sharply on Friday after the Labor Department reported a drop in the U.S. unemployment rate. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled more than 630 points, or just over 2%.
Hiring slowed in September as U.S. employers added 263,000 jobs. That's just the kind of decline the Federal Reserve's been hoping for to help take the pressure off wages and inflation. Investors were spooked, however, by news that some 57,000 people dropped out of the workforce last month. That helped push the unemployment rate down to 3.5%. Rising gas prices could also add to inflation after OPEC and Russia announced plans for a deep cut in oil production next month. The sell-off at week's end erased much of the big rally the market enjoyed on Monday and Tuesday. Still, all the major stock indexes managed to eke out a gain for the week, with the Dow climbing nearly 2%. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
And you're listening to NPR News. Power has been restored to around 99% of Floridians about a week after Hurricane Ian tore down power lines and ravaged other critical infrastructure. Gabriella Paul of member station WUSF reports on the communication challenges and near total power outage cost.
Hardee County Emergency Management Director Amalia Arista says that during the storm, operations headquarters went dark after losing power and backup power.
At one point, we lost all of our communications, so we had to use our ham radio operator to actually communicate with Tallahassee. That, combined on top of everything else, was pretty chaotic. In one word, chaos.
Since then, power and cell service has been restored to most residents. For those that are still offline, responders are planting 10 plywood boards across the county where information can be physically posted. For NPR News, I'm Gabriella Paul in Tampa.
In Ohio last night, a shooting at a football game in Toledo left three people injured. Police say the shooting happened outside the stadium, and the school district says the injured include two adults and a student. Officials say they are expected to recover. Local television reports say people ran to the field house for safety after the shots rang out. Organizers calling today a day of action around reproductive rights. 1 month before the midterm elections, women's marches are planned in Washington, D.C. and in cities across the country following the Supreme Court decision that overturned Roe v. Wade. The event's being held today after courts put holds on abortion bans in Ohio and Arizona. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to solve social and environmental problems to improve lives today and benefit future generations. More information at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Laura Flanders is the host and executive producer of The Laura Flanders Show. It airs on PBS stations nationwide and is recorded right here in Sullivan County. She's an award-winning independent journalist, a New York Times best-selling author, and the recipient of the Pat Mitchell Lifetime Achievement Award from the Women's Media Center. Next Sunday, October 16th, Laura hosts her show live from the Catskills at Catskills Provisions in Calicoon with acclaimed author and activist Bill McKibben and other special guests. And joining us live in our Liberty Studios this morning is Laura Flanders. And on the phone, it's Claire Marin from Catskill Provisions. Good morning to you both. If I can turn your mic on, you can hear her.
Good morning.
Hello, hello. Thank you for joining us here, Laura. As we've said, you air on public television stations. You launched your show in September of 2020, and you're recording from home. Was that the intent to work from home, or is this kind of COVID-related?
It was kind of COVID-related. Can you hear me okay?
Oh, here we go.
I'm really here. It's good to be here. Tim, it's fantastic to be here, really. Congratulations. These new studios are wonderful. Everything is super. And I'm a huge listener to JFF, round the clock.
It sounds better if I press the button.
Well, you know those buttons. But, you know, the show has been around for many years in different forms, but we launched on public television, in 2020. And I didn't intend to be doing it from a cabin in Smallwood, but I'd had a cabin there for 30 years, and COVID brought me here full time. And we figured out, actually, where better to do a national television show about making change at the local level than right here in Sullivan County. So that's what we did.
Exactly. So you air on public television stations across the country. But for folks who may not know the show, can you tell them a little bit about what they can expect?
Sure. Well, I say the Laura Flanders Show is the place where the people who say it can't be done take a backseat to the people who are doing it. So our whole idea is to lift up and report on models of positive change making in the worlds of arts, politics, and economics. You know, I was a kind of war correspondent in Northern Ireland, in the Middle East, in Central America, you name it, even Rwanda, for the first 20 years of my journalism experience. And then I began to think, okay, we have a lot of media telling us what's wrong. We need some media that gives us some idea of what we can do to make a better world. And that's really what we've been doing ever since. And that's what we brought to public television. And frankly, Tim, you know, when we first started, I thought, independently produced in a cabin in the Catskills, how many stations are going to play the show? We have 300 stations picking up this program. People want an alternative, and they want programming that includes a wide, diverse spectrum of people who are building tomorrow's future today.
And do you find that that's because from the regular media, the diet that folks have, it's sort of this constant drumbeat of similar topics?
Yes, I do.
The election,
Well, you know, I think that's what money media is all about. You know, commercial media likes to keep us, I believe, looking upwards to other people in power, people in politics, people at CEOs, people in Wall Street, people in politics a long way away. Let's remember they mostly only cover our presidential elections. And that's not where change happens. Change happens at the local level and works its way up. And so I think independent media, media like yours, community media, if the commercial media, I always say, delivers audience members, delivers the public to the advertisers, community media delivers us to each other, introduces us to each other, and together we figure out how to make the change that we need to make.
You're in the same boat as we are, nonprofit, listener supported, no corporate underwriting.
No advertising, no corporate underwriting, no money from government, and no money from public television. I mean, let's be clear. Public television as a service has never been funded to the degree that would produce enough resources to produce, you know, to fund programming. So you have a handful of shows under, I think it's, you know, a handful, mostly children's programming that is actually funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Everything else you see on your precious public television station is either funded by that station through donor contributions or independently produced like our show. And most national shows like ours are independently produced.
Well, that's our case too. We get some funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, but the majority of our fundraising and the majority of our donors, donations are from listeners. Listeners
support. Well, and that's how I want it to be, Tim. Yeah, I don't know about you. I'd prefer not to be in the pay of the people that bring you war and chemicals and, you know, agro. Let's be in the pay of our listeners and viewers. Right. It's a good model as far as I'm concerned.
And our fellow business folks in the community, like Claire. Claire is hosting you for a fundraiser next Sunday at the 16th. The Catskills Provisions in Calicoon, the woman-owned gastro distillery. Claire, have you always been a fan of Laura Flanders?
Well, I mean, I have to say, since we've met, which was, I want to say it was during COVID.
It was.
Possible. And since then, the moment that I looked at her current work and then past work, you know, just such an incredible history that you've created and incredible work. So the moment we met, we said to each other, you know, we do have to find ways of working together because I too agree so much with, you know, independent thought and, you know, with all the lobbyists and all these, you know, this big money agriculture for us, for example, is huge, you know, and I just can't say enough, obviously, about Laura's work. So I'm very proud to call her a friend and, you know, want to do more and more with her for sure.
What Claire doesn't know, maybe she does know by now, is I'm not going to, I mean, I am a healthy liver, absolutely. But how did I get through COVID? Pollinator gin.
I think many of us did.
If you haven't tried it, try it. It's unlike any gin you had before. It's my absolute number one fave. And I'm originally English, so that's saying a lot.
That is a big endorsement. So at the distillery, I'm sorry, at the Catskills Provisions on the 16th, you have, it's an in-person event. You have a special guest. Tell us about author and activist Bill McKibben.
Well, Bill, you may know from 350.org, the climate campaign group that he founded a few years back. And it was the group that really brought us the largest demonstrations around climate change that we've seen in the streets of Washington and New York during the climate conferences at COP. And, you know, 350 has been active all around the country in the years since. He has now moved on. 350.org moved into new leadership, is being led now by an amazingly diverse group of folks who are really keeping the action going. He's now founded a group called Third Act, which is for baby boomers, people 60 and above. He says this is the generation, and the reason we wanted to bring him here and that he wanted to come is that he says, you know, this is the, I don't know what he calls it exactly, but it's kind of like a Janus face, two-faced generation. On the one hand, you have the best, the Woodstock generation, the anti-war generation, the early ecologists, the activists, many of the people we know around here. On the other hand, you have the very generation that has consumed more carbon fuels, has created more climate eroding gases than any other generation, just by virtue of when we were around. Since 1950 to now, we have consumed, I think, 2/3 of all the chlorofluorocarbons that have been emitted into the atmosphere. So he says this particular generation has particular responsibility. He also says we have resources. Young people are out in the streets, and that's fantastic, but we can't leave the future to them alone. We're the ones with people. We're the more likely to have some resources in the bank. We're more likely to have some power. And let's face it, most of us are of the age where you can't mess with us anymore. What have we got to lose? So he's going to be talking about Third Act and inviting people to join this organization, and in particular to bring their power to bear on the big banks. He says if you have more than, I don't know, a few bucks in the savings account, your money sitting in the big bank, your money sitting in the big banks is causing more damage because of how the banks invest it than no matter how much air travel you do, which was interesting to me. So he said, we need united action by people with some resources to affect Wall Street and the banks. And he's pretty effective. So we'll see what he has to say. And then I just have to also mention Taina Seeley. I don't know whether you've ever heard her sing, but she's in the Albany area. She's Puerto Rican. She's going to bring us news from Puerto Rico. But her music is extraordinarily inspiring. So that she'll be a treat.
I wanted to mention also that Bill's book is titled along is based along these lines you're just talking about.
In
his book, Bill McKibben's new book, is called The Flag, the Cross, and the Station Wagon. A graying American looks back at his suburban boyhood and wonders what the hell happened.
What a great title, right?
And he'll be there with book signing and doing participating in that. You have a live stream as well on the Sunday, the 16th. From 4 to 7. You're producing this in not only with Claire, but also with Catskill Mountain Keeper. How did that come together?
Well, Catskill Mountain Keeper are fans of Bill. Bill's fans of theirs. Turns out they're fans of the Laura Flanders Show. And who better? I mean, Ramsey Adams and his family will be there on Sunday. He's a hero of mine. And let's not forget, people here in the Catskills did what they were told was impossible, which is to stop frack gas, to stop fracking. They didn't go for some compromise. They said, no, we don't want it at all. And again, that's exactly the kind of story we tell on the Laura Flanders Show. Possible, you know, actions, usually community-driven actions that expand what is possible. Here in New York, we expanded what is possible in terms of climate policy. Mm-hmm. We did what people said was impossible. And now no legislator anywhere in the country can say, oh, no, that can't be done. It was done. It was done right here. Catskill Mountain Keeper led the charge. And we're going to be celebrating with them and getting on board for all the charges they're leading next. The one on the top of their list is the Birds and Bees Protection Act. We all want to preserve the birds and bees, and Claire's involved in that.
Yeah, Claire, you donated a portion of your proceeds to help the bees, to help the pollinators. That's a key to your business, too.
We do. I really started the business as a socially responsible business. You know, there's no reason why, you know, we can have profitability, make good jobs, make good products, but also help our community and everything around us. And, you know, starting the business up here in the Catskills in 2010, it was a very different place than in 2022. Definitely, you all remember, there were few businesses, very few things had Catskills on it. You know, and the plight of the pollinators was really not well known, you know, and it was really happening. You know, you mentioned fracking too. That was a huge reason why I started the company, to bring more attention to food businesses so that we could actually grow better things on our land instead of having some of the land go to frackers, you know, and give the government a reason to rethink that. You know, today the distilling group, which is over 140 craft distilleries in New York State, brings in $15 billion to the state. It's been a tough road, but at the same time, I think, you know, we definitely made a dent in it. I was a big proponent of no fracking, and I remember even having conversations with Mark Ruffalo way, way back then. There was a, you know, a lot of obviously protectionists and you know, people like Vicky, who, you know, just wonderful, wonderful community involvement up here. And Ramsey Adams' work, of course, was huge.
Yeah. I remember that time as well. And, you know, it almost felt as if just it was impossible. You know, you saw the pro fracking signs. You felt as if maybe we couldn't make this change, but everyone did.
Yeah.
And in some ways, there's some parallels to some of the political atmosphere that's going on right now. It almost seems a little impossible, but you're bringing this
I mean, that's
change.
Why I love it here. I mean, I've done radio in San Francisco and radio in New York City for years, but here and making my show here, it's sobering because you're surrounded by not one point of view.
Right.
We have a I mean, right on my block, there's a Trump sign at the bottom of the hill. There's a, you know, save the bees sign at the top of the hill, but I live somewhere in the middle. I've been here also since the 80s and 90s, coming up feeling that division. The fact that we were able to come together to the degree we were around fracking, you know, is the story that we need to be telling these stories. Do we all agree? No, but we figure out how to move forward. And we figure out how to live with each other. We don't just move to someplace else. We don't like our neighbors. And you can do well by doing good. I mean, look at what Claire is doing, and not just her. She's been leading the way of small businesses that are doing well by doing good. Now, is she a multinational corporation that wants to buy every other distillery in the country and put everyone else out of business? No. Right. She wants to have a good business that supports her people and supports her place and supports her community. And that's what she's doing. And I think that there are so many stories to tell like this, that if our media told us more of them, we might be less afraid of one another and less afraid of change in the future.
Yeah.
We can do this, people. But our media tells us, it's you against the other guys. And, you know, you just should be very, very, very afraid and sit in your cabins and buy guns.
Yeah.
Like, no, well, it's funny. We can do better.
The coexistence thing is really what makes it special here, I think. And I agree with you that I there's something special about it that I hadn't really been able to place a kind of a tagline on it or whatever you want to call it. But coexistence is key to living here and what makes this place such a special place. Claire, you've had a front row seat on Main Street in Calicoon, as you've said, and you see the change. And how do you see changes kind of afoot now after COVID and more people staying up here full time?
You know, it's a great point, Tim, because being there, one of the things that has happened is like I've opened my door to people coming into my house, so to speak, right, and giving me their commentary. And there are a lot of questions. I do feel like I'm a bit of a concierge for the area because it's, are you buying a house? And do you need contractors? And should I buy here? Should I buy there? Where should I eat? You know, there's always all this recommendation that we do, you know. And it's been really interesting to have a whole influx of people during COVID that probably would not have been introduced to the area, possibly, you know, people that were staying at their aunt's house or my grandparents' house or my parents or cousins, you know, people just borrowing a little space to hide during COVID. You know, there was a lot of that. And coexistence was something that I was asked about constantly. How do you feel, you know, as a lesbian woman here running a business? Can you, you know, feel safe and comfortable? And, you know, my biggest thing is that I do love that quality about being here. My wife and I, she introduced me to the area, Kathy Leidersdorf, this in 2003. And since then, I've never had an issue with anyone in particular making us feel anything that was less than accepted and you know, a way that we could hire people that work here. We don't have to hide. We give to the community. We, you know, we're kind people. We're supportive. We're generous. All those things, you know. And so, you know, a lot of that difference that we have, you know, that the media really exploits to make it into a war, you know, and it truly is not. You know, we are coexisting, living together and making, you know, we all want the same thing, right? We want to live in a good place to you know, have good relationships, to live a healthy life and find that happiness that is so elusive and so, you know, that we're trying to figure out exactly what that is.
I'm totally with you. And you can hear how Claire is a pollinator. She pollinates ideas and information. And I will say one of the sweetest moments of my COVID experience was not to do with COVID at all. Let's be clear. COVID was not a sweet experience. But in the depth of the winter last year, I was in my cabin where we produced the show. And I'm just about to begin the program when one of those storms happens, or really it had happened the night before and I thought I was fine. I went around, looked at the house. We have these big trees around and nothing had fallen. I gave, you know, thank my lucky stars. And then next thing I knew, I sat down in front of my table, crack, this huge part of a pine tree next door flew onto my roof. and crashed down. Luckily, didn't break it through the roof, but I was there in a cloud. If you've ever had a tree fall on you, you can't see out any side. You don't know what has happened. It takes you a while to figure out what happened. Within 5 minutes, a guy up the hill, who I know is a Trump supporter, and he was anti-masks and anti-vax, comes driving by to see if I'm okay, you know, and help me. And I was fine, and he was fine. And that's, you know, we not only coexist, we depend on one another, and we work it out with one another. And I, too, my partner and I, Elizabeth and I, we are probably referred to as the crazy women on the hill or girls. But, hey, we all have – we have an amazing life here, and it's I'm really learning a lot, and I love being here year-round and in the depth of the winter rather than just coming up at the weekends. It's a whole different experience.
Today's October 8th, 30 days until the midterm elections. November 8th. Can you think we can take that feeling of coexistence through the next 30 days and beyond?
Yes. I mean, we all just have to participate. We have to do what our hearts lead us to do. We have to get everybody out to the polls. This is a critical election, more critical. I mean, we say it every year, but more critical a midterm than I've ever seen. I don't really love either party, but as one, I prefer way over the other one. I think we have been seeing some great things out of the Biden administration, action on things that we never thought was possible. What about marijuana possession
just
basically being decriminalized this week and thousands of people being let out of prisons and jails? I mean, that's actual progress. And we've seen progress on the climate. Maybe not enough, but we've seen some. And we've seen progress on fighting poverty. Maybe not enough, but some. And we've seen what you can do when you invest in people. We can't let this opportunity go by, because to go down the other road, I'm frightened. I mean, I've been doing a three-part series on the roots of the January 6th insurrection, in just one state. We went to North Carolina and went to one rural part of North Carolina, and we saw what's happening there in terms of arming people, terrifying people, preparing people for war, electing people through sketchy means that will collaborate with paramilitary organizations. We're in a very dangerous situation, and we need to talk to each other, and we need to vote like heck. Mm-hmm.
We've been talking to Laura Flanders of The Laura Flanders Show. Next Sunday, the 16th, at Catskill Provisions in Calicoon, New York, at 4, there's a fundraiser for the show with Catskill Mountain Keeper. You can meet environmentalist Bill McKibben and support the public TV and radio show that airs nationwide on the PBS network right here in Sullivan County.
We're going to have some special guests showing up, too. I mean, you mentioned one of them. I hope we can get Mark to come. I heard today that V, formerly known as Eve Endler, is going to come. We're going to have a great group of people. Come out, join us. And if you can't be a port person, you can get a ticket to the live stream at lauraflanders.org.
And Claire, before we go, we have Art Walk. You have Art Walk in Calicoon today. What do you have going on at Catskill Provisions in the town already?
Thank you. I'm super excited. We have two artists that I'm so happy to host. There's Haley Burt, who works with us, actually, who's an amazing photographer. She's done some work for us already, so you'd see some of her food related photography. Gorgeous stuff, really shouldn't be missed. And then we also have Victor Raul Garcia, who is a modernist painter, lives locally as well, and lives right in Hankins, and super talented, lovely people too. So please come down. There's so much going on in town. I can't even honestly. There's a long list. There's a beautiful map, easy to follow, and every single business really has a lot going on. So I would definitely recommend that you come down.
Great. So Art Walk today in Calicoon from noon until 8. And then next Sunday, it's the live in-person Laura Flanders Show at Catskill Provisions. Claire Maron, CEO and head distiller of Catskill Provisions, and Laura Flanders, host and executive producer of the Laura Flanders Show. Thank you both for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Tim, and thank you, everybody, that supports WJFF.
Thank you. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. This is Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill and Catskill Brewery present Apple Pie Palooza, Saturday, October 8th, 5 to 9 p.m. at Catskill Brewery in Livingston Manor. Eat pie, win pie, bring home pie. Enter the Apple Pie Baking Contest at WJFFradio.org. Plus, Dancing in the Tent with WJFF's DJs, Jason Tuga, Nick Forte, and me, Cassie.
Apple Pie Palooza, October 8th, benefiting Radio Catskill.
This is Kai Wright. I grew up in the Black Church, and my favorite part of service was the fellowship. The hugs and winks, and just check-ins with all these people. I want to create that fellowship on the radio. Every Sunday evening, I hope you'll join me for Notes from America, a live national show. It's a place we can gather to share experiences, process, and figure out where this country is going together. Join me and join the conversation. Sunday evening at 6, live on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Center for Discovery is a leading provider of healthcare and education services for more than 1,200 children and adults with complex conditions and medical frailties. It's located right here in Sullivan County, and the center and the John A. Hartford Foundation released a report last month that shows the Center for Discovery's model could hold a key to healthy aging. I spoke with the center's president, Dr. Terry Hamlin, about the report.
I think it's very exciting when we think about aging. I think our model is really what one would consider a preventative healthcare model. And although people talk a lot about preventative care, there's no one that's really doing the preventative care. And I know that, you know, insurance companies, nursing homes, I mean, everybody's interested in it because it not only allows people to live a healthier life, but the costs associated with preventative models are much, much less than what we typically have, which is really a sick care model. And what I mean by that is that people, you know, wait until they're sick or have signs or symptoms, and then they go see a doctor, and then they're treated. And, you know, oftentimes, especially in the elderly population, they have multiple illnesses, and they don't necessarily see the doctor as frequently as they should or could. And so it ends up, you know, costing a lot, but people can get, you know, even sicker, you know, because of the lack of preventative care. And I think that's, you know, our model was designed to be preventative first and foremost, to really help individuals who have complex conditions. But I think, you know, having NORC here and having them extract the key features of our model that could be applied in a nursing home or in any sort of long-term care facility or in a home environment. If an elderly person is living at home, extract key things that can just help them live a better life and a healthier life, so that they don't experience all the multiple comorbid illnesses as they age, and, you know, can live longer, but can live happier and healthier. So I think it can be a game changer. I really do. It doesn't cost very much at all. And it sort of refocuses that sick model into something that I think is joyful and something really positive to think about and to have an elderly person really experience.
Your model is called the Health-E6 model. Can you explain in layman's terms what that means and what that looks like?
Sure. We did coin it the Health-E6 model because there are really six core features that we look at here. And there are 18 then elements associated with the six core features. But those core features begin with evaluation. So we really want to understand a person's biology from a health perspective, their behavior in terms of how they live their life and how they engage on a daily basis, and then their environment. Where are they living? What's their situation? What are their social supports? What are their supports in the community as well? So we really want to evaluate the person from that, you know, that core, and I call it the crossroads of complexity, those core features of evaluation. And then we really look at the environment. So what is the physical environment? Where are they living? What's the temporal environment? What's the rhythm to their day? And who from a social perspective is supporting that person? So that's the environment. We look at eating and nutrition. You know, our motto here is that food is medicine, and we grow almost all of our own food here at the center. But we look at the quality of food, the quantity of food, how much is someone eating, and then the timing of meals. And, you know, that's really important for digestion and for a healthy sleep. And we know that sleep really impacts how a person functions. So eating and nutrition, that's the third E, if you will, in Health-E6. And then energy regulation, how much exercise is a person getting? How are they sleeping through the night, the quality of their sleep? And what's that daily rhythm look like for the person? We also look at emotional regulation as a core feature of being healthy. How is someone able to self-regulate their emotions? Are they really anxious, or can they take bad news and sort of understand what that is and then move on so that they don't end up in a depressive state? And then do they have empathy and self-efficacy? And self-efficacy, do they really believe that they can accomplish things, and, you know, whatever task that is or whatever project they set out to accomplish? And then really evidence-based education and treatment, which is critical. So whatever we're doing with the individual, whatever goals we set, are they working? And are we collecting data and understanding every perspective to ensure that someone has a quality of life and, you know, that they are achieving their goals and their aspirations for themselves? So there are six features that all begin with the letter E, so, and it's all preventative health. So it's the Healthy Six model, and it's something that we've implemented here at the center for over a decade now. And, you know, our data clearly demonstrates that the individuals who are part of our system here are doing quite well. We have very, very low rates of any chronic diseases, you know, especially compared to other centers like ours. But even in the general population, our chronic disease levels are almost non-existent. I mean, they're a fraction of what you see in the general population, and especially in a population of individuals with disabilities. We also have a number of individuals who are elderly individuals as well, also living almost all cancer-free. We don't have diabetes. We have very limited obesity here. I mean, all the things that you're seeing in the aging population as really, really problematic issues for people in terms of managing their health, we don't really have that here. And we really do attribute that to the model that we've implemented here at the center.
The report did emphasize how the model works well because of your staff members who are engaged and trained and well supported by the center and its mission-driven, dedicated leadership. That's a quote from the report. And so that's got to feel good. They mentioned also that there is room to improve, particularly in the area of end-of-life care. The issue is becoming particularly acute as older adults are outnumbering children for the first time in U.S. history. You mentioned the older population at the center. How do you plan to take that indication of trying to find more support for older population as you build and adjust your programs for that group?
Yeah, so I think that's one of the challenges that the system in general, in the system built for individuals with developmental disabilities, really hasn't caught up to the fact that people with disabilities, by and large, are living longer, and they are experiencing some of the same problems that you see in the general population in terms of dementia, Alzheimer's, things that require a different level of care. And the system here in New York State, and I would dare say throughout the country, is naive to that right now. I think they feel that everybody who is disabled needs to work until, you know, they're 90 and attend programs, and that's how you're funded. And what we're saying to the system is, wait a second, these are individuals, and they are living longer now, but some of them, you know, are going through stages in life where they are dying, and they need to do that respectively. The system needs to change so that there are people who are supporting these individuals through the end of life. And right now, if we have somebody who is going through a dying stage because they are elderly, we are forced to discharge them to a nursing home, to another place. And, you know, society does that often with the elderly. They end up in nursing homes for their last, you know, 13, and I think that's the average stay in a nursing home, their last 13 months because they have severe dementia, or they have Alzheimer's, or they have a medical condition that a family can't treat. And we're trying to say that that needs to change, especially for the disabled population, and let us build a continuum of care that supports that individual through the end of their life and allows them to stay in their home environment or at least surrounded by people who they know, who they, you know, have taken care of them for a long period of time that they're comfortable with so that they can die with dignity. And I think everybody should die with dignity. And so we are in that conversation now, really trying to change how the world of disability thinks about people who are aging with disabilities. And it's not easy to change a system, unfortunately. But, you know, we've changed a lot here at the center and have really enriched the system. So we're really committed to that. And, you know, you mentioned our staff. We could not do anything here if we didn't have the quality of staff that we have here at the center. These are remarkable people who, you know, even through COVID, you know, put individuals here first before themselves, before their families. I mean, they were just so committed. We didn't even have a death here, which is unbelievable considering how the field suffered and, you know, how individuals, especially with comorbidities, were the target of COVID. We had everybody remained healthy here at the center, and that was the loving care that our staff provided, and just were so protective and supportive. It was amazing.
Your tagline, if you will, at the center is "What happens here matters everywhere." And so when you see a report like this that says that what you guys have been working on for so long could be translated to a wider range of care in settings across the United States or the world, what does that mean to you? What does that mean to you personally?
And it's so important. I feel like the work that we've been doing here is really, really incredible. But it's time now to share our model with the rest of the world. There are so many people in need. I travel frequently. I do a lot of lectures overseas, and I've seen so much of what the world looks like in terms of how it helps people with disabilities and the elderly as well. And there's so much that can be gained from our knowledge here. There's so many of us here at the center who have been here. I've been at the center 40 years, our CEO 42 years. There's many of us that have been here that have now, you know, gained such such knowledge about living with people over time that we can share that knowledge. And I think we've put it into a framework now that's replicable. And so having NORC here really a stamp of approval, a gold stamp of approval on what we're doing and helping distill things that could easily be, you know, translatable to other situations was really, really important for us. And I think our work will continue and it will continue in a much bigger way now because, you know, we can spread the model and really affect more people. That's just so important to, I think, all of our life's work here.
Before we go, do you have an update on the facility at Rock Hill? You're building the Children's Specialty Hospital, which will include the Research Institute, a state-of-the-art biobehavioral and healthcare facility. How are things going?
Yeah, it's moving along nicely despite all the economic factors that are in play right now and obviously the issues with COVID. But the hospital is moving along. You know, we're heading into winter, which we all know what happens around here when winter hits. So we're hoping to get a lot of the exterior work done, especially the painting of the building, which will be this beautiful white with the center's colors throughout the white, but get the building painted. And then the finish work on the interior can get done through the winter months. But we are we're a few months behind, probably 3 months behind or so, but we're hoping to open in early spring. So really very exciting.
We've been talking to Dr. Teresa Hamlin, president at the Center for Discovery, the Center for Excellence for Children and Adults with Complex Conditions, including autism spectrum disorders, medical frailty, and other rare disorders. We've been talking about the new report from the John A. Hartford Foundation, which shows the Center for Discovery's model could hold the key to healthy aging. There's more information at thecenterfordiscovery.org. Dr. Hamlin, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations.
Okay, thank you, Tim.
This is Radio Chatskill. We'll take a short break and be back with more.
The 2022 Radio Catskill Community Awards are Thursday, October 20th, celebrating our local media for their outstanding local journalism, courageous conversations, and community commitment. The honorees are the Student Journalists of Manor, Inc., the River Reporter, the Sullivan County Democrat, the Shawangunk Journal, and Bold Gold Media, with a special recognition to Barry Claxon of Canvas. Join us October 20th. Tickets at wjffradio.org.
The January 6th committee is making what could be their final arguments in their case against former President Donald Trump.
The former president lied to his supporters, made them believe that the vice president had the authority to overturn the election.
Join us for live coverage and analysis of their next and possibly last hearing Thursday from NPR News.
Your NPR station, Radio Catskill, keeping you connected.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Sullivan County Museum in Hurleyville hosts an event tomorrow afternoon at 2, celebrating the republication of a classic local history book, To the Mountains by Rail, written by renowned rail historian Manville B. Wakefield. The book is groundbreaking in its treatment of the details of the New York, Ontario, and Western Railway, or the New York, Ontario, and Western Railway, or O&W Railway, and its exploration of Sullivan County history. Local historian Myra Gattell was instrumental in the republication project. He spoke with WJFF's Barb Demarest.
So a classic book of local history, To the Mountains by Rail by Manville Wakefield, is being republished after being out of print for many years. Can you tell me a bit about the original book?
Wakefield was an artist, and he did many of the artwork in the book. He drew a lot of most of the maps, I believe, and took some of the more modern photographs and did what they had to do. They called it Wakefair Press to put this book together. And it just amazed. The more you know about it, the more it's just such an amazing feat, you know, without even saying how they do it without, you know, digital communication, but they did it. And it came out in 1970, and second edition came out in 1976, and then in 1989, which they published themselves, 1989, a regional press, Purple Mountain Press, out of Fleischmann's, New York, they published the 1989 edition, which is the last time it was in print. I don't know how long till that edition ran out of copies, but then it was a big used market, and I just, you know, this is the first really local history book I discovered, and I discovered some of his articles and talks, Wakefield, before the book came out, and then I was hooked. So when it came out, I got it, and I've been involved in history ever since, so.
A lot of those earlier copies are really valuable at this point. Now that you're going to be reprinting it, what do you think that the reprinted version will accomplish?
The new version is reprinted. So many people have original copies, and one's from 76, and it was their grandfather. It's been passed down literally for generations. And I know every time I'm a volunteer at the Sullivan County Historical Society, and every time you take an original book out and you open it, as much as you want to be gentle and you try to show something, show a picture or a page or loan it to a patron, it deteriorates. It goes down. So my goal was, for many people and families that have the original, this could be their rough copy, the copy that they could open and not have any fear that they have to treat it like such an antique heirloom, which it really is. So they could show it and show it around and take it to other people to share. It's hard to do that with a book that's over 50 years old, that's had a lot of use.
And crumbling.
Yeah, what's that?
And crumbling.
Yeah, literally. And also, there's so many new people, as we all know, coming to the county. I wanted to get them involved. And if I came out with another edition, it'll be for a heck of a lot less, you know, the retail price than for what's being sold, for the price of the old editions, and it would be better.
Right, right.
So if I found the right printer and all, so that was a bit of a 10-12 year challenge. I joke around. I say Wakefield finished the book in a shorter period of time than it took me just to reprint it.
That's amazing.
And it's true. It took me like 12 years. It was a very tough, because it went from non-digital format to now digital is how the only way printing is these days. And there were so many pictures that it was more of a burden to reprint, because you're taking a picture of a picture that was had been taken of another picture. So it was really, but we did it last November. And it's out, and it looks beautiful.
And these are some really extraordinary illustrations in this book, aren't there?
Yeah, yeah. He knew. He got right down to it in the road, and then not just the railroad, even the prehistory of that, you know, going to the canal, the Delaware and Hudson Canal, even, you know, the history of transportation. You know, we're bordered by the Delaware River on the west, and he talks about that as a, you know, commercial avenue. So it was, if you look at it. And some of the pictures of the Delaware River, of rafting, it weren't a lot of choices. There weren't a lot of great pictures taken in the 1890s and afterwards. So he had to pick the best they can, just to pick, to depict this particular situation, which he did. So, you know, they were a little challenge to begin with, but some of them were the only thing that was around.
Sure.
And it was, and he found them. And people just opened up, and the Sullivan County Museum in Hurleyville, which he was the president of that society, you know, they were a big factor in a lot of the pictures and photos and slides that he got for the book.
So the Ontario and Western Railroad, the O&W, these days we may know it more for the rail trail, but where did the O&W run, and when was its heyday?
Okay, I just double-checked my facts before I'm talking. It was about in the 1860s and 70s, you know, 1860s, and it took a few years to build, and at first it was the Ontario Midland. It had a different name at the beginning. There was a big conkout raid, bankruptcy raid for railroads. Everyone wanted to get in on it. They wanted to get a ground floor opportunity, but they didn't always know what they were doing, number one, and they didn't always have a decent marketing plan or a business plan. So there was a lot of bankruptcies, and this bank, this railroad, it changed its name like about 1873 or 4 to the Ontario Western. Years later, it went through bankruptcies, at least one. So it had its rough times. But it went from its past. None of these railroads took off, actually, it said New York, but they really left from either Weehawken or Jersey City. And people and freight had to take, there were ferries that ran across the Hudson very regularly to meet those trains and to bring people and freight back and forth.
The Hudson Tubes, right?
No, that was underneath. This is on the river itself.
Oh.
Yeah, no, the tubes, right, brought people back and forth. But the ferries, and there were, these ferries had trains. Trains were on the ferries. It's hard to picture. I mean, I grew up in the city in the 40s, so I remember seeing those. So none of the people actually left from Manhattan. They went to either Jersey City or Weehawken on the Ontario, on this railroad.
And that was the start of the tourist boom of the Catskills.
Yeah. And the railroads, there was a lot of things to potentially pick up. You know, a lot, eventually there was milk, there was crops, it went through, you know, and it went to one of the Great Lakes, Oswego. So in that case, it was also going to another port, so it could transport. It wasn't going, other trains went straight up to Albany and then know, to the northern, straight up north to the northern part of New York.
Right, right.
That kind of took an angled route. It kind of went northwest instead of north. So it was, they had a different business plan. As time went on, then it helped to develop the tourist industry, which it did, and then farming developed, you know, much greater up in, you know, Orange County and north, so milk went back to the city, and people came up and back and forth. So it worked, but, you know, we talk about the heyday, you ask. Actually, from a point of view of passengers, I think it really peaked before 1920. The roads were starting, and of course, this is what killed the railroads, but, you know, automobiles were a big growth industry, certainly after the First World War. There was more resources and people. And as the roads start getting built and getting improved, rail kind of started, peaked and was on a down trend. That doesn't mean tourism in the area was on the downtrend, because tourism was still increasing. It was just, as time went on, more people were coming by.
People were coming in a different way. Right, right.
So yeah, we want our conveniences, and if we can, we don't need to, you know, we don't want to wait for a train at four, you know, at different times.
Sure.
We could get in the car and go.
So there's a program that coming up this Sunday at the Sullivan County Museum in Hurleyville. What are going to be covering in this program?
Well, I'm going to be covering a little about the trials and tribulations of getting this book in print. And, you know, that happened, and it was a story, but it finally got in print. A little about the history of the book and the history of my involvement, as well as, you know, we're going to be in the museum, Sullivan County Museum. It's been around for just about 55 years, just had its birthday anniversary. And I'd like to talk and show people more around the museum, because the museum is really the star in my, of when we talk about Hurleyville, and this is a Hurleyville day, that's one of the most interesting places in Hurleyville, and from my mind, in the county.
Thank you so much for talking to me and telling me about the program coming up and about the reprint of To the Mountains by Rail.
Okay, well, thanks.
Myron's discussion on the book To the Mountains by Rail takes place tomorrow afternoon at 2 at the Sullivan County Museum, located at 265 Main Street in Hurleyville. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder that our first Apple Pie Palooza is tonight at the Catskill Brewery from 5 to 9. We have an apple pie baking contest. It's not too late to enter. Go to wjffradio.org. You could win. You can bring home a pie. You can eat pie. And you can dance. We have dancing in the heated tent with WJFF DJs Cassie Carlson, Jason Tuga, and Nick Forte. And the pie MC for the contest is our own Jason Dole. So that's today at 5 till 9 at the Catskill Brewery, Apple Pie Palooza. The brewery is at 672 Old Route 17 in Livingston Manor. We hope to see you there. Thanks for listening. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll see you next week.
Support comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com.
Tavern on Main, a neighborhood bar and restaurant on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York, featuring local American fare, specialty cocktails, craft beers, and Sunday brunch. Menu and hours online at TavernOnMainNY.com.
And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Our music sale is the Saturday after Thanksgiving, and we are still taking donations of all things musical. Right now, we really need some high-quality vinyl. LPs in great shape, collector's items, or even some rare records. We also need stereo equipment, turntables, and receivers in clean working condition. Support local public radio while making sure no one leaves the music sale empty-handed. Donate to the music sale. Email manager at WJFFradio.org. Thanks.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello.
Public Radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. Radio Catskill.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.